what I want to do tonight, as best I am able, is to do a combination of taking questions and then doing some additional teaching. And so in a way, the meditation itself was a kind of teaching. So I would like to start with any questions you have about this sequencing of arriving, available, and aligning, to include why you don't like it, if that's true. that's all fine. I don't know why I feel, I hope I'm not dark on your screen. I feel so dark on my screen, and I don't see why I am, because I've got these lights on. Maybe that'll be better.
I'll move you don't look dark, Philip.
I don't? Okay,
good. No.
All right, well, good. All right. My failing eyes. So let's start with anybody's experience. Someone that has just some sort of, had some sort of genuine experience about their own sense of being available, like being mindfulness being so strong they were available, or their own experience, their direct experience of what it felt like to align with something that made their heart lighter or made them feel more confident. Just anybody with any kind of an experience, whatever that was. Okay, Corey.
Sure, I really appreciate it. I never really thought about aligning, and it really helps when it helped me with less, just flying off on the mind on other things. And I think about my Qigong, just coming back to the belly as a place to just kind of be directed. And then I could go back to mindfulness and just not be so flighty and my mind go off to planning and things like that quite as much. So it was nice as a start, and it was also a nice place to go back to instead of the breath.
Yeah, thank you for that insight. I agree with every bit of that, so I don't have any comment. Okay, let me see another hand here. Oh, Liz.
Hi.
Hi, Liz.
Could you talk a bit more about aligning with what? In the mindfulness training that I'm doing, which I find really annoying, is always going to thoughts and emotions and then dealing with them with rain or self-compassion. But aligning with the Dharma, aligning, please define for me aligning with what.
Okay, so the importance here is this is preparatory practice. And the reason that I'm preparing the mind-heart to turn to objects of experience in the mind, because that's what mindfulness does. That's going to be our second part of the evening, is mindfulness is employed in the teachings to look at the objects of experience, and in the training you're getting there, keep pointing you to the third satipatthana, to be mindful of what arises in that regard. It's what you're reporting, and that's fine. But that's all about utilizing mindfulness. What I ask you to do this evening, what I invited you to join me in the experience of, is being in a state to do all of that satipatthana, the four foundations of mindfulness. But we weren't doing any of those. We were aligning with our aspirations. That's what we're aligning with. Wise view and wise intention are aspirations. Wise view is the direction we're moving in towards freedom. Wise intention is showing up in this moment in a way that we don't cause harm, have kindness, and have the capacity of restraint, of being able to have restraint so that we don't get carried away by what the mind wants to do. So that's what I utilize. But other people are so inspired by the Buddha that that's what they would use to align. Yes, there was a person who did this, and I can feel the possibility of that, and I align with that, or with Dhamma, that I truly believe that we are capable of knowing ourselves more deeply. And that I'm aligned with that. I'm inspired by it. I aspire to it. It lifts me out of my ego kind of wanting to do things well or to get things to be comfortable. All of those things that cause the second noble truth thirsts that arise.
Thank you. I appreciate
that question in that way.
And thank you.
Thank you. And then available, man. I first started teaching this. I looked in my notebook in 2004, and so that must have been. I don't teach anything that I've not practiced for at least 2 years. So, available is. I didn't even. It was so intrinsic to me that I was a while noticing that available is a state of mind that can be a capacity of mind that can be cultivated. So I started out in my own practice where I trained myself to ask myself throughout the day, am I available to the Dhamma? And that was, I realized I was not going to be a monk and so forth. And I kept adding practices that would give me the kind of a structure that as a lay person on my own that could work for me, that could work for me. And being available to the Dhamma was, that inspired me. That did create a kind of alignment. I was so inspired by being available to the Dhamma because I was being available but aligned with the Dhamma. So I was available, aligned to the Dhamma. But then over the years, I became much more inspired by the available in my life to life. So I seek to be available to life. I seek that. I seek that. So whatever I'm doing, I want to be present. That's the mindfulness front and center. Because if you're not mindful, you can't be available in that way because you're not here. None of us are. I seek to be available. So in all these different situations in my life, I want to be available. I want to have that feeling of being available, which includes the mindfulness, but it also includes an openness. I'm not just this way back here looking at it. Present. I am present heart-wise in the flow of the moment. And when it's woeful moment for me, either because of my own shortcomings or the heartbreaking cruelty of the world, which is very heartbreaking right now, as you all know, I still wish to be available. So there's a felt sense to available. There's a felt sense. I know that felt sense so well in me. I know the vibe of it. I know it's kind of energetic patterns, all of this, because I've worked at it so long. I am completely, completely serious about this. This is not some, here's a nice little technique you might think about including. You could tie it into the Greeks and to all these people in other ways too about being available. But none of that really matters. In the Buddha Dhamma, one is available in order to practice, in order to have freedom. One is available to walk the path. But walking the path means you're available in the moment. You are the Eightfold Path, you're available. But it doesn't have to be heavy laden with the Buddha doctrine. If you feel your heart available, because you've had enough experience with Buddha Dhamma, it will be there. So anybody, any question about that or any like something you've been experiencing about available? Anybody that was, so let's start with you, Jan, and then Allison after that.
I think what I heard you say about available, I wrote it down, is that you're not just an observer, that you're a participant. So I think that's the distinction, because I can be mindful and really observe what's going on, and I back off. And what I heard you say is I'm in my life to life available. So that took it somewhere new for me, redefining the mindful in a way that's very helpful. Thank you.
That is what I meant, and it is slightly different than often the way it's taught, because you're taught to be so far removed from the experience that you're actually separate from yourself. And I'm not so sure that's how change happens, you know, if we're not within ourselves. But that's just a view. But anyway, so yes, what you said is correct experience with that. I don't want to get off and view an opinion. Allison, please.
Hi. First, thank you. Thank you for the reminder that in terms of the satipatthanas, that any one of them is the wholesome and rich path that will go everywhere, because I've certainly made the mistake of thinking somehow it was a sequence and that, you know, one was the foundation for the other and the greatest getting was by, you know, the last one. And it's not, it's that assumption has been very contrary to my experience, because I align with the first one. I align in my body. And that becomes the doorway for the others for me. And the other thing is that for so long, I always thought aligning came first for me. But then I realized that, you know, I needed to like dumb down my definition of available, because just to decide, okay, I'm going to sit now and I'm going to get still, is becoming available. Or every time my mind wanders, or if I'm naturally concentrated, I don't need to pull in availability again, but the practice of concentration takes becoming available over and over and over and over again. And so I am understanding now the substructure of that, and it's so subtle. It's so very subtle, and it does become, there is no aligning without availability.
Well, of course, since that's my view, I really like your view, your new view, but I didn't understand that available would be subtle. I missed that. I missed that. I did not understand that. Because we all are available for things. We've all chosen to be available for many things in our lives, and we all sort of in some ways strive to be available, you know, like being available to your child if you're a parent, being available to your friends, you know, being available to, you know, someone who's dying. I mean, we use that word a lot, and we have a feeling about it, but I don't know. I don't quite understand yet why this is. I'd anticipated more of a universal, yes, I get it, than I have received back. And I can't remember now how many years I've been teaching this and this sequence and all, but I'm learning from it. I'm learning from other people's experience. So it's, I really appreciate all of that about all of you, and when you give me feedback here, because I'm learning how to do this, because you know, I'm wondering in some way if we've learned to not be available to life, to be slightly away from life or something, because it's so upsetting, it's so tough. I could see why that would have happened. So I'm really serious about this. I'm meaning I'm really encouraging you, from all my experience, to really explore this sequence. I'm really encouraging you to know availability directly and so forth and so on. So thank you, Allison. And now Veda, and then, well, I'll go down my list here. Veda, and then the Bowman and Sherry, and then Jerome, and then Ron. And then we'll stop with that and move on. So Veda, please.
Yeah, last 10 days, I've had I've been snarky. I have not been kind to just people in the market. I've not done a really good job with people at my clients. Way off my usual. And as you were talking, I realized and I don't know if it's because of what's happening in the world, which is a bit depressing. And I can't formulate it yet, Philip. But there's something about, you triggered something. It's something of not being available to my practice. And I don't have a super deep sitting practice, as you know. But I live my life sort of aware of the Dhamma. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I have been. I don't. So I'm not quite sure what I'm saying, except I want to thank you because I realize I've been off because I have not been practicing my practice.
Yeah. Well, and it can be I can feel that I'm not available. I'm not fully available. And you can feel that. And that's why I started with this great compassion. Because in this time, I really encourage all of you towards great compassion, the great compassion. Because it is difficult to be available. Who wants to stay present with all of this? You know, we won't name what this is, and I don't want anybody naming what this is.
But it is.
there is so much suffering and wars and this new whole round of starvation, of children starving, all those things, just on and on. So how do we stay available? And available to ourselves and available to people that we're in relationship to. And in your instance, relationship of serving. How do you stay available? And sometimes it's only so-so. But that's the truth of it. And that doesn't mean you're supposed to hate yourself or be mad, but rather that you're available to be available. You know, sometimes you have to go way back. And, you know, those of you who've studied with me know how much I like this sequencing back. But being available to be available, like remembering to be available. And so the mindfulness is just says, oh, I'm not available. I'm not even available to staying mindful, let alone staying to intention of what I'm aligned to. And, oh, wow. And that's the great compassion. When I started using this word phrase, great compassion, it's beyond description, really, what I mean. And it's there in other traditions, too, this same idea of this great compassion.
Thank you
for sharing that. Okay, I don't know which of the two of you are going to speak, but Bowman?
Yes, hi. Philip, that was really wonderful. It was so wonderful to meditate with you and to help me to be available to life. And it really, you know, cracked my heart open. So I just want to thank you.
You're most welcome. And that being available will do that. The challenge of it, and I'm being really honest here. I'm not making this sweet and easy, because it feels like if you're available, it's going to break your heart in two. It's not, but the trick is, because of all of our practice, we can have it break our heart open, or we can stay present in this vast desert terrain of the mind heart, where it's just so vast and so everything's dead in it. I speak from personal experience here, and through that we become available in a more profound way. We don't go around those things. We're never going to get to the other side if we go around. So thank you for sharing that. Jerome, and then Ron.
Hi, Philip. So good to see you.
Good to see again.
I want to thank you for a great meditation. I wanted to point out that Thich Nhat Hanh says, I have arrived. I am home. in the here and the now. So, and then he talks about availability after arriving. And I'm wondering how you relate to arriving and availability.
Oh, I do it just, I guess, like he does it. You have to arrive to be available. You have to arrive in the here and now. You have to bring mindfulness front and center. We have to establish ourselves in attention in a certain way, and then to have intention come through the alignment. So, yes, so it sounds similar. I now that you've said this, I remember hearing that, but I did not make it. Again, Analia was my great inspiration to going ahead and offering this as a practice to everyone. Gave me confidence because I saw the benefit from my practice with him. He did it in a very different way, just using suttas. But because I was very sick the week I was doing that with him, and because I was really real sick, and I had hardly any life energy, and yet there it was. So for you, and then for myself, you know, I want to be available for what's happening as best I am able, and to have certain qualities present in that availability to the extent that I am able. And that is the orientation of the practice in that way. And to me, it then goes back to this way that I have been for these last years, saying that there's three things. You know, the Buddha teaches suffering and non-suffering. What does that mean? He says, I teach one thing, suffering and the end of suffering. So the first is that you recognize what's suffering and not suffering. That is very hard to do. Very hard to do. Then the second is to recognize that there is choice. We have to be available, and then to actually have the oomph to make the difficult choices oftentimes, we have to be aligned. And then we have a choice of being able to choose between suffering and non-suffering. Sometimes we can't. I watch me, you know, times that I'm mindful, and I can't choose non-suffering. That's why it's practice, and that's why we're practicing practice and not results. Because if we're practicing results, we get into judging and fixing and all that. And then the aligning is that you either believe or don't. That's not the right word to say it. You either have a felt sense or you don't, that there is something beyond the ego's relationship to the whole. And so we do that. So thank you, Jerome. Okay, Ron, and then I'm going to move on here for a minute.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much for the meditation. And what I'm going to say is different than what I would have said when I raised my hand, because everything that's happened in between. I'll start with the experience, which was to drop into a really wonderful place that I haven't been in for a while during your meditation. So thank you. And what's forming in some way is a question about the experience of availability or being available. That is, it may be large enough to encompass what I'm about to say, but I had this sense that in order to be available, there has to be something else that I'm not being available to. There's something else that I'm leaving behind. There's a choice. And some ambiguity about choiceless awareness and choice, and something complicated for me. And I don't know how much of this is me personally and how much is personness, but there's, what do we bring with us? That is, there's an experience that I have of awareness that is simply what is happening here. But in order to do that, I'm leaving other things behind. And it's a challenge in my life, as well as in meditation, of course, about what to bring from what I'm leaving behind, wanting to empty the cup, but also to honor what has been.
Mm-hmm.
I just wonder if you could speak in some way to that complexity.
So in the Nine Bodies meditation retreats, where I do these sequence of arriving over and over and over and over and over again, every single meditation they do, when there's any guidance, this is done. I have room to explain about the need for renunciation, because when you're available, you realize that the mind can think of anything, and you can have an impulse to say all sorts of things or do things, and you know people want to deny that, but it's just the nature of mind. The mind's again, there's a teaching in the Nine Bodies that explains why that's true from consciousness point of view, just capacity of consciousness. But whatever, we all know this is true. We think all sorts of things. We find ourselves hating someone in a way that's ugly, you know, or whatever it may be. That's just an example. And so if you stay being, this is going to be a more subtle answer than maybe some of you are ready for. Just don't worry about it if it doesn't make sense to you. My nature is to stay available for quite a long time before I go to alignment. I'm not encouraging that in others, because since I was a little boy, I've wanted to look everything in the eye that I found disquieting. I was not someone who pulled away or glanced away. I just was straight in. And so therefore, I've had a lot of experience with seeing the need for being able to do renunciation, when you're available, to make deliberate choice to not be available to things. That, again, it can be lust. It can be lust after a new car, or lust after a sexuality you're not even capable of anymore, or it can be lust after a more just world where you're wanting to demand that there be a more just world, and you're lost in the bigness of your emotion, which you would kind of kill for peace, you know. So all sorts of things, little things, big things, personal, impersonal groups, your family, all these different aspects, dimensions, layers of it. And so yes, if you're going, but at some point, you can't sustain that's not the right way to say it. At some point, it is my experience that one can't sustain available in a wholesome way. Because when you, being available, it has an ethic, because of mindfulness being present, we're already tending to a positive ethical stance. But available in the end is available to all the things that our mind's capable of. And so to not get lost in all of that, we need the alignment at some point. But if you're going to, in your daily life, when you see yourself available, you really are present, and you see it's things that there's things that are not skillful here, one thing to do is go to available right then, because you don't want to get lost. So you stay a little while in that confusion, then you go to available, to alignment, so that you're now available, aligned, or aligned available, depending on how you experience it in your head. And then the other thing to do is to get really interested. And where you are, when you feel that the necessity of choice is one of my big, big, big words. Again, I don't have as much chance with this Sangha as I had for 17 years, which was almost every week. But this choice really matters. And so if you're going to be serious about this, if this kind of practice, you really get to know yourself in choice, and you can see when you lose choice. You can just be very mindful of choice, and you can empower yourself by having a deeper relationship with choice. Choice is understanding choice. Now, again, we're not into objects yet. Objects might be arising when we're doing this preliminary, but we're not going over there and studying the objects and what's a wise relationship with the object. And we'll talk about that in a moment for a very short period of time. But But this is in this preliminary of preparing the mind heart. So is that pretty clear what I'm saying, Ron?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, and I felt something in you today that I have not felt before. Like there's a new level of you showing up for yourself that's in this. So don't treat that lightly. It's like it doesn't hang around. These windows open, but these windows close. So again, I'm being frank with you as though we were alone in the room, but from my own experience, I have seen windows close where I assumed a duration of time to go in that window or not. And boop, the window closed. Okay, I wanted to speak for a moment. Thank you for all of your comments. And all. I wanted to speak, and you said tonight, 8 o'clock, but in the past I've had this instruction to stop at 7:30. So I'm going to compromise in between here. I don't know if that was a little unclear about which one was to do, 7:30 or 8, but I won't go to 8 o'clock. Mindfulness is this being able to be present for what's going on. I talk about the participant observer. I don't mean to create an observer. I should maybe talk about the feeling of participating and observing, maybe the verbs, because in the language it would be more appropriate. But anyway, I don't mean to create a separate observer or anything like that, but this participant observer. And so in the first noble truth that there is dukkha, it's not enough to be an observer of dukkha, but rather you're willing to feel the ouch of dukkha. You're willing to stand under the ouch, or that to me is the direct path the Buddha's pointing to. That's the path that felt sense, that direct perception. That is my understanding of the Buddha's teaching. Not others, but everybody agree, but there's all sorts of views about everything. But that is one way to understand it. And so sati is this one way of our, this is being mindful of the objects of experience that arise in the mind. Satipanya is having a wise mindfulness. So you have a wise relationship. You're developing the wisdom that allows you to have a wise relationship than whatever arises in the mind. When it's something that's unwholesome or overwhelming, if possible, the mindfulness and all of our practice allows us to move away from it. That's right effort in the Eightfold Path. But lots of time, it's got us, and we can't move away. It's overwhelming. I feel as though for so many people right now, the state of the world, the things that are occurring is overwhelming. I encounter all these people that are bogged down in it. So when we can't move away, then the answer is to have a wise relationship with what's the difficult in us, in our situation in life, in our relationship with other people, other people's relationship with other people. If we can't take our mind away to a more wholesome mind state, then we develop a wise relationship with in whatever way we're caught in dukkha, that we're experiencing dukkha. And that wise relationship we get through the mindfulness, because we learn discernment. So Liz, in your teaching, if you're going to be teaching people, teach them discernment. And it's not judging and comparing. Mindfulness, wise mindfulness leads to discernment that brings wisdom. It's discerning what's suffering and not suffering, going back to those three things of knowing what's suffering and not suffering, knowing you have choice, and then choosing choosing non-suffering. So it's discernment. And the Venerable Sumedho, I discovered long after I was doing this, he went through a period of time when he was using this word discernment. And discernment is different than judging or comparing or fixing. As most of you know, I on retreats ask people to take a vow of non-judging, non-comparing, and non-fixing. But I'm not asking them to stop discerning. But rather, if we don't sink down, collapse into, grasp, cling to, judging, comparing, and fixing, then we're available for discerning. We see what it's like. We say, oh, it's like this. We say it's like this. And because we understand there's choice, we look for what's the possible choice here. So we empower ourselves to a sense of well-being, to a sense of having greater choice. Very practical, but very, very real. In our inner experience, in our subjective experience, we're not changing the facts here. If we can change the facts of malnutrition, we'll do that. But that's not what we're talking here about, how to relate to our subjective experience. And then I've taught many awareness retreats, and many of you have been on those awareness retreats. But awareness is not the same for me, at least, as mindfulness. Mindfulness is being mindful of objects of experience. Awareness is this innate, mysterious capacity for consciousness to arise and be utilized in mindfulness. It is a capacity, but mindfulness is in there. Mindfulness goes towards the object and penetrates the object. Awareness is utilized for that, but awareness itself it doesn't touch the objects. It is this innate capacity. And I've said many things on many different retreats. I'm not going to repeat those. But the importance here is that which knows, that capacity becomes... Well, so if you're not going to be all involved in objects, you know, pleasant objects, unpleasant objects, the whole four foundations of mindfulness, if you're not going to be involved in all that, what do you do? What do you do with your attention? What do you do with attention? Because we're going to pay attention to something. We're not wanting to be spaced out. We're not wanting to be non-attentive. What do we do with our attention? One thing we do with our attention is we just rest back in mindfulness. Rest back in awareness. We rest back in awareness. We're just resting back in awareness and we really mean that. We don't mean we're moving away from the mindfulness of the experience. We're not doing that. So I hear this used, I'm just resting in awareness. And when I listen closely, it appears to me that what they're saying is I go to the mindfulness of, I'm mindfulness of the object, but I'm not experiencing the object anymore. That's not what I'm talking about. So I'm upset, and so now I'm aware I'm upset, but I'm not feeling the ouch of the upset anymore. That is not what I mean by resting in awareness. Because if in that sense I'm saying, no, stay with the ouch and have this observing capacity of that, so that, because you're discerning, so you can have a wise, compassionate relationship with objects. That's all the mindfulness practice is. It's mindful of all these objects in this way. Awareness is like coming, resting back in awareness and exploring the nature of awareness is a different way into finding freedom and well-being. Each enhances the other, but I'm very doubtful that you can just rest back in awareness without a huge amount of training. So I do think people are disconnecting a bit. And I invite you to think about that in terms of your experience, not judging others. It's not the value's not in the view and opinions about that, but rather, what about you? What about me? How am I doing with that? Do I do that? Do I disconnect thinking that's awareness? I'm very careful about that personally. And so that's for your consideration. And because I've introduced this new subject, I'll take two questions and then we'll stop. My goal is to stop at 7:45 midway. But so about this thing about awareness and about this understanding mindfulness related to what arises in the mind and awareness relating to the capacity of mind itself. Any, if there are, there may be no questions or comments, but you can make either one. Someone who's not spoken yet, please. Corey, I think you spoke.
This is for Margaret.
Oh, okay. Hi, Margaret.
Hello. Thank you. So I just want to clarify, because for me, awareness is going to stillness and then like resting there.
So awareness is characterized by stillness. And I so wish you could have been on that retreat I did sometime in the last 12 months on stillness and movement. I captured it the best I've ever been able to capture that. But yes, that's right. Awareness is for me stillness, because it is not moving towards objects. And if you can feel the stillness is a predominant characteristic. It is still and still moving. And that's... I try to explain that scientifically why both of those can be there together. But anyway, I'm not going to do that tonight. Yeah. So yes, but mindfulness moves towards the object. It's interested in the object, and it's got an aspiration of seeing the object clearly, so it can choose non-suffering. It's very wholesome mindfulness. The wisdom comes from the mindfulness. Awareness itself isn't emanating. Its value is something different than that, in my view of it.
Thank you.
Most welcome. Anyone that's not spoken, I'm going to give it to someone that has spoken before. If they don't, okay. Anybody that has spoken before that wants to ask or say something. Once, twice, three. Okay, Corey.
Sorry to monopolize. Choiceless awareness. So I'm trying to, I haven't been practicing choiceless awareness as much lately, but I really appreciated that stillness comment, because when I'm able to get to choiceless awareness, it does feel like resting back, and it does feel more receptive. And yet there seems, is there maybe a transition in choiceless awareness that goes from where it is object-based, and then it's that sort of fades away? Or can you explain that a little bit?
So you have choiceless awareness, as I was taught it and the way I understand it, is that you're not using an anchor, you're not investigating anything particular, you're not cultivating a skill. You are simply being present for whatever is arising in the mind heart, and you're relating to it. You're seeing through. You're using satipatthana. You're cultivating satipatthana of wise mindfulness in relation to this whatever arises. And you're steady enough. Your mind's concentrated enough that allows that to happen. If the mind's not concentrated enough, you know, something arises that's moderately difficult even, and it can knock you off. But if you've got enough concentration, and that does not mean like jhana, not being absorbed, but it does mean a level of a neighborhood concentration, access concentration. So your mind's steady enough to be able to take all these difficult things that can arise and stay choiceless. then to me, there's often a sense of well-being in that state where the mind is fewer and fewer objects arise and I get more concentrated. I don't really, it is to me a change in focus to say that I want to really know awareness itself. I want to move towards awareness. So your mind's lost interest in objects, so you're available to explore awareness. That's the way I would describe it in two sentences. Well, we've come to the end here. We're going to be doing the metaphrases in just a moment. I wanted to say that in September, we are doing a nine bodies insight practice in online. And if you have not come to one of those and you've been interested in my kind of approach, the way I approach Dhamma, I would suggest it's worth your while coming to one. It's pretty intense practice, but although it's online, in that we do two guided meditations a day that are, and but people really get, people also get really concentrated, but it's for a lot of people, it's been very, very useful helping them with their regular other ways they practice Vipassana. Well, there's all these different styles now of Vipassana. This is just a method of practice that has helped a number of people. And what you explore is these different dimensions. I call them our capacities of consciousness. More than I had any hint of, there's some kind of change occurs when we do that. I did not know that would be true, but it turned out it was true. So I wanted to mention that to you. And there's also some introductory courses around that. You can just go to the nine bodies. You just type in nine bodies and explore what's available or not. Wanted to say that. And then I wanted to say, let's all of us hold the world together in this great compassion. You know, anicca is always true, and this too will pass and change in some way. May get worse before it gets better our particular country. There's so much discord now, and holding it in compassion rather than in spending all of our time judging it. We have our views, and we all might have similar views, and we might have different views, or views, same views on some things and different views on others. Who knows? But that's not the level where we get things worked out. It's in this great compassion and the oneness. You see, because that separateness of our views, it makes us seem so separate. But the experience is much more like we're all in one boat. You know, that's the way. The more I age, the more I experience that. We're all in one boat. We're one big giant plant, one big giant tree, whatever you may find as an image with that. But really, like in your home practice, you wake up in the morning, you know, may I have compassion for myself and others this day. May I be part of this great compassion that holds possibility.